And now a visit with New York Times columnist and well-known political commentator Frank Bruni. But it won't be about politics. If you read Frank's columns and newsletter, which you can sign up for at frankbruni.com, you know that he recently woke up blind in one eye and then learned he could lose sight in the other as well. And so being the reporter he is, he turned on his metaphorical headlamp and dove into the darkness of blindness, finding light in James Joyce, John Milton, James Thurber, and a fan named Joel Burkett, who reached out to Frank, all wrote while blind or sight impaired. Frank's working on a book about the experience. Frank Bruni, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So you say this is often referred to as a stroke of the eye. How strange to wake up with that. What is it?
Well, you said wake up with it, and that's interesting. It most often happens to people overnight. It happens. It's very rare, 1 in 10,000 people. What happens is often while you're sleeping, for some reason, sometimes they know the reason. In my case, they don't. There's reduced blood flow to one of your optic nerves. Mm-hmm. And essentially, while your optic nerve is not getting enough blood, it's dying. I woke up and the vision in my right eye was completely blurred. Mm. And I remember that morning so well. I thought, oh, you know, I just have some gunk in my eye or I haven't caffeinated enough, and kept on not understanding why the vision in that eye would not defog. Mm. And that ended up sending me on this long medical odyssey.
Right. You said to your doctor, this is bad, isn't it? And she said, yes, the thing you don't want to hear. But what rushes through your mind when you're realizing what's happened?
You know, there's so much adrenaline, which almost is a saving grace, that, you know, I didn't grow immediately depressed. You know, I didn't break down and cry. But it's a very it's a very strange thing to be sitting in a doctor's office and to be told not just that what had happened to my eye, there was no treatment for it, and that I would almost certainly never have functional vision again in my right eye. But in the next breath, this doctor told me there was a 40% chance that it would happen in my left eye. Now, it turns out that estimation is an outlier, and it's more commonly believed that the odds are about 20%. But when the stakes are legal blindness, a 1 in 5 chance seems way too big.
Yeah. No solace, I'm sure. But I see with one eye. I had a lazy eye. Surgery couldn't make it perfect, so it's slightly off. So instead of seeing double, which I can do if I want, it's a great party trick, but the brain tunes the bad eye out. The only thing I didn't do well was make the crosshairs match when I flew in an FB-111 fighter bomber. But there is that fear, I know, of the other eye.
Yeah. No, well, I mean, well, first of all, as you said, a lot of people get through life with vision in only one eye.
Yeah.
And it can mean we don't have as good depth perception. I'm constantly, when I'm trying to text on a phone, I'm constantly hitting the wrong key. Mm. I'm like one key off because of my depth perception. But all of that, you mentioned the brain, and
right,
it's amazing. I've done a lot of reading and research. The brain's an unbelievable thing, and it makes extraordinary adjustments. I've seen it happen already to some degree with me, but more than that, I've interviewed and met people whose brains have sort of created workarounds for their disabilities,
right,
in ways that really just wow you when you take a close look at it.
Yeah. But meantime, you know, you're tapping at a keyboard, you're public, you know, very public, you know, on CNN often. What's it been like to adapt?
Well, it's been quite difficult, to be honest, because I read much more. I mean, my work is reading and writing, and I mean, my work is words, and I've always been a very fleet writer. It's one of the things that has served me well, and I've been a fairly fleet reader. And now, in both cases, I have to think and concentrate a lot harder because I sometimes do slip into double vision. Sometimes my vision, it's hard to describe, it gets diagonal. I just really kind of have to grit my teeth, find a way to work through it, and find a way, I think most importantly, and I think anybody who's gotten any sort of physical setback or limit understands what I'm about to say, find a way not to let my mood go south because of it. I think that's the most important thing of all.
Yeah.
Because if you begin to get not just frustrated but sad and angry and depressed, I think that's a hole that's very difficult to get out of.
Well, you do such a positive, self-affirming thing, which is you start researching writers who were blind. John Milton's Paradise Lost, and a scholar tells you that Milton thought that he was able to write masterpieces not in spite of his blindness, but because of it. Milton said blindness was the price he was paying for inner illumination.
Well, I think, you know, what I learned when I studied vision-deprived or utterly blind writers is they ended up having to lean on their imaginations, you know, in whole new ways. There was a rather famous British travel writer, and I believe it was the 19th century, who was blind and who was writing travel books, but from the perspective of somebody who was essentially hearing places and smelling places, actually quite well-known, quite acclaimed. And it's just a phenomenal thing when you think about it that you can go to other senses. And while you've lost something, you can gain something as well.
Yeah. I once did a story on then considered the world's leading authority on seashells at the Smithsonian. Blind.
Yeah.
Never sighted. And you write about Borges, the Argentinian writer, poet, who said that blindness is a gift. It's just like any tool that you're given as a writer, like, okay, here's this, like clay, he said. But then he also wrote a poem that you turned us to. He writes, "I long to see just once a human face. Unknown to me, the closed encyclopedia, the sweet play in volumes I can do no more than hold, the tiny soaring birds, the moons of gold. Others have the world, for better or worse. I have this half-dark and the toil of verse." That you said that was ennobling, but that's also frightening, isn't it?
It is, but as I was listening to you read it, I have to tell you, I teared up. What I love about it is on the one hand, there is such sadness there. He is letting you know that there are these beautiful things in the world that are denied to him now. But look at what he's done with that loss. He has woven from that loss the words that you just read, which are so beautiful and so human and so moving. So there's a sadness, but there's also an elation to what you just read because it was created from loss.
What are you hearing from people?
It's interesting. When you have – I guess I have a disability. I don't know. It's hard to quantify because, I function pretty much just fine with the one eye. But when you are struggling with something that's not visible to people, no one notices anything odd about my right eye, which is fairly useless to me, and nobody would have any way of knowing that my left eye is imperiled. So one of the ways in which I feel I have been changed by this and I'm grateful is I'm much more sensitive to how much struggle there is out there that none of us can see. And I think there's a really profound and important lesson in that. And I've been able to learn it in part because people meeting me or even people who know this about me but don't see evidence of it daily, they have no idea what I'm going through. And I shouldn't expect that they do.
Does that help you with some of the response you did get from readers who wrote to tell you that your blindness is because you're gay? And some of them in very, I'm so sorry to have to say this to you, some not so nice. You say this is the kind of hate that you often get in your mailbox as a political commentator. But, do you have a different reaction to it now? Or
I think maybe I do. I mean, maybe it's always been my nature. But, what comes to me as you say that is one of the more hateful emails I got. Actually, there were several. Was from a woman. She used her name. And she's a professor at a college in Manhattan. And these were extraordinarily homophobic emails she sent me. And I shared them with some friends just saying, can you believe someone who's actually a professor at a college would be trafficking in this kind of thinking and this kind of hate? And several of my friends said, well, you should forward that to the administration there because they'd probably fire her. And I didn't. Because, A, if that homophobia is showing up in the classroom, I think we live in a day and age, thankfully, where her students would notice it and they would say something and they would be listened to. And if it's not affecting her teaching and it's just something in her heart, I don't know how it got there. I don't want to orchestrate her demise just because she spoke hatefully to me because she's not affecting my life. I think there is a kind of forgiveness in that decision and a kind of acknowledgement that she may be way more complicated than the email she's sending me. Maybe that is a kind of empathy that is a legacy of what I've been through. And maybe it's not even the right thing, but I do connect the dots that way a little bit.
Frank Bruni, again, you can read him in the New York Times Week in Review. We'll also link you to his newsletter at hereandnow.org. Frank, we look forward to the book and wish you well. And I would just say, do not fly shotgun in an FB-111. That would not work.
Thank you so much for the conversation and the opportunity.